As talks began to unite the colonies, the Transvaal tested out ways to control the Indian population.
In 1906, the Transvaal, which is still the Transvaal colony, passes an ordinance which says that the Indians in the Transvaal would have to carry a registration certificate on their persons at all time, and that this certificate would bear their thumb impressions and finger impressions, and that it was very much like a pass, which African people also carried at that stage. So this, Gandhi thought, was really, you know, the ultimate discrimination, and that they should absolutely not accept this because they were being treated like criminals. And they felt that if you didn't fight this now, then, you know, things would simply just get worse.
In 1906, Mohandas Gandhi went to London. He wanted a reversal of the Indian registration certificates. This was the Earl of Elgin's response.
I do not know why the imposition of a thumb mark in itself should be a very debasing operation. In fact, as they say, it has always seemed to me a most marvellous thing that they can trace every thumb mark. There might be an advantage over the hieroglyphics which some of us call our signatures.
Mr. Gandhi.
It is a 10-finger mark.
The Earl of Elgin.
Is it more debasing with 10 fingers?
It is difficult to say what will be the ultimate result of the enforcement of the law, but as far as I and my co-workers are concerned, we are determined not to submit to the proposed registration. We feel that having absolutely no voice in the legislation of the country, even when it affects ourselves, the only way that we can resent legislation is by respectful non-submission.
There's very little doubt in Gandhi's mind that Smuts did not play quite the straight card with Indians. There was a compromise that he had reached with General Smuts that, Indians would go and voluntarily register, but then Smuts would remove the legislation. And Smuts doesn't quite do that, and Gandhi regards that as a breach of the compromise.
Yes, they had an agreement about gradually allowing greater civil rights for the Indians. And it does appear that Smuts was the one who went back on the agreement, because Smuts at no point was going to give way seriously. He made it absolutely clear that there could be no equality of the races. And that is exactly what Gandhi demanded. He didn't necessarily want to have large immigration, continued immigration of Indians into South Africa. Even half a dozen a year would be acceptable if the principle of racial equality was accepted. So it was very much turned on that question of the actual principle that Gandhi demanded and Smuts refused to countenance.
Smuts really thought that Gandhi was quite this wily lawyer, and if you read Smuts's biography written by his son, well, his son has no great fondness for Gandhi.
My father's trouble with Gandhi began in July 1907. It never really finished. By the time an Indian assassin's bullet ended Gandhi's life in 1948, the whole Commonwealth had become involved with this diminutive man. It was almost by accident that he came to be connected with South Africa.
John Smuts and Mohandas Gandhi had problems with each other's tactics, but there was also a mutual respect between them.
Gandhi, though clashing frequently with my father in the old days, was an understanding and forgiving person, bore no grudge. In fact, even when he really had reason to feel sore with my father, at the time when he spent a year in Pretoria Central Jail, Gandhi showed his friendly spirit by making my father a stout pair of leather sandals. Now these, like Gandhi's friendship, my father kept safely through the years.
I think they had a great deal of respect for each other. But Gandhi was an infuriating opponent, because from that very early stage he realised that it was probably tactically sounder to not use violence, to use his passive resistance, to go and be arrested and his followers in great numbers, to absolutely gum up the legal system. So he was a very persistent, very able and very cunning opponent.
Satyagraha.
Gandhi's mission politically was to unite people, and of course legislation does tend to unite people. And so it brought together the wealthy and the poor, the hawkers and the merchants and so forth in this act of resistance. And it is during the course of the campaign that Gandhi says, you know, we need to have a new name for this campaign. We can't call it passive resistance, because passive indicates a point of weakness. And if you're going to offer passive resistance, well, then maybe the next step would be violence. But we are not, violence is never a step for us. But we need our own name for this movement. And so he has a competition in an opinion, and he asks for a new Indian word to describe the movement.
I have received one which is not bad, though it does not render the original in its full connotation. I shall, however, use it for the present. The word is Saragraha. I think Satyagraha is better than Saragraha. Resistance means determined opposition to anything. The correspondent has rendered it as Agraha. Agraha in a right cause is Sat or Satyagraha. The correspondent, therefore, has rendered passive resistance as firmness in a good cause.
The first jail sentences go out in 1908, and then people, you know, really willingly go to jail, but then, you know, the jails are getting full, and then traders are now threatened by the state with confiscation of their property and expropriation, and people are then deported, and some people then lose courage, and then numbers begin to dwindle.
As I go to jail, I see that many Indians have given in. It is left only to a few Indians to continue the campaign now. I am undeterred by this fact.
And then at the same time, Gandhi becomes more, you know, a spiritual, and he begins to say, well, wealth is not everything, and you need to sacrifice, and, you know, the true Satyagrahi is the one who has no fear and who has no love of wealth and of possessions and so forth.
This is a fight on behalf of religion, that is, on behalf of the universal religion which underlies all religions. Had I not believed so, I would never have advised the community to invite grievous suffering on itself. I believe that sacrificing one's all in a struggle like this should in no way be difficult. It is the duty of every Indian to forget all thought of relatives and friends, to sacrifice wealth and life in this struggle. I pray to God and I beg of all Indians that all of them fulfill this duty.
And as he begins to talk like that, the numbers of supporters actually begins to dwindle. And so by 1909, 1910, he's got just a handful of people, you know, and then the campaign slumps.
Those who have fallen can rise again. They can still go to jail. I hope they will rise.
And so he totally embraces a life of poverty, and this has a big impact on his family, because, you know, there was this wealthy lawyer, Western dressed, and then he has this dramatic transformation, you know, within a couple of years. And his entire family were settled at Phoenix Settlement, and all the young boys would receive their school education there, taught by people who also worked in the printing press. Now, Manilal Gandhi was Gandhi's second son, and he really wanted to study. And so there's this dialogue that takes place between father and son. And Gandhi writes to Manilal and says, he's in prison, and he says, my dear son, you know, you must...
Dear Manilal, I have received your letter. You got nervous at the question, what are you going to do? You need not worry about the future. Your parents are doing that for you. You must be definite on this point at least, that you are not going to practice law or medicine. We are poor and want to remain so. Money is required only for maintenance. The true occupation of a man is to build his character. While writing this, I feel like meeting and embracing you, and tears come to my eyes as I am unable to do that. Blessings from Mohandas.
By 1909, General Smuts had written a draft constitution for the Union of South Africa.
Mr. President, for a long number of months, the advisability of union has been thrashed out at the National Convention and by the public of South Africa. And more, the impression has deepened that the step was wise, and that union was in the interests of the Transvaal and of South Africa as a whole.
But, you know, the Union of South Africa was one that actually excluded black people. You know, black people were not part of the negotiations and their wishes were not taken into consideration.
The proposed union has dangerous implications for Indians and other coloured races. They will be left with no voting rights anywhere. And care has been taken to provide in the report that they should be deprived of whatever little measure of such rights they enjoy in the Cape. The existing laws of the several provinces will remain intact. That is, whatever laws against us exist in the Orange River Colony, the Transvaal and elsewhere will remain unchanged. We shall be allowed no right of movement from one province to another. Moreover, the new parliament will be empowered to enact fresh legislation. The result will be that the harshest laws that exist in any of the colonies or provinces will be taken as models elsewhere.
Now, sir, we propose to sweep away all the existing political institutions of South Africa, and we propose, in effect, if I may put it so, to go back on the creations of almost 100 years. We propose to sweep them away and to put in their stead entirely novel machinery for the government of South Africa.
In 1909, General Smuts sailed to the United Kingdom with the Constitution for the Union. An Indian delegation followed to present their case to the British.
The tickets for the voyage were bought at 11 in the morning of the very day of departure, Monday, June 21. Even after that, it was not certain that it would leave. The government was free, if it chose, to arrest the other members of the deputation. Some thought that the arrests might take place even as the members were about to board the train. All the same, the deputation started on its way. Park Station was crowded with Indians. About 500 Indians must have assembled. There were so many who had brought bouquets and garlands. This at least could be observed, that every face was lit up with the hope that the deputation might meet with success.
The British had to concede that Gandhi's arguments about the rights that British people accepted ideally should apply to South Africa. There's no doubt that Gandhi tugged at many consciences.
Mr. Solomon.
My dear Smuts, I've gone completely through the Asiatic Acts, and I enclose a memorandum which I would like to discuss with you at any time convenient to you. I see no reason why Act 2 of 1907 should not be repealed.
Now, these were seen by the Liberals as being bad in principle, but also they were seen as being betraying the whole point of the Boer War, because one of the things the British in justifying the war was to say, look, these Boers treat the Africans and the Indians appallingly. We will treat them better. But of course, this was not the case. And the Liberals, particularly Liberals in the House of Commons, they spoke out very powerfully against accepting this. But the South Africans said, well, if you don't accept this, there can be no union. And the desire for a united South Africa overrode everything.
Lord Amptal, Viceroy of India.
Dear Mr. Gander, yesterday morning I received a letter from General Smuts which he had written hastily on the eve of his departure. I fear from what he says that General Smuts is not going to meet us on the question of right.
And it came down to that point that Smuts would simply never concede the principle of racial equality. He would give way on practical details. When it came to the principle, that was not negotiable, because they looked ahead and saw, as I've remarked before, if you had racial equality, then there will, eventually there will not be a white South Africa. They saw it as a matter of life or death. And so from the very start, it was a white government. And in a sense, the directions were already set for apartheid after the Second World War.
It was on the 20th of September 1909 that the British Parliament passed the Constitution for South Africa. The country, with its race-based laws, would come into being within the year. Mohandas Gandhi had to face the truth that even the British in Britain condoned the treatment he received in the colonies.
There was some considerable dialogue between Gandhi and radical Indian students who were in London. And in listening to their views and arising out of Gandhi's really extensive reading on the writings of Tolstoy and others, Gandhi began to believe that one needed to look at India's liberation in a very different way and to advocate a totally non-violent solution.
I came in contact with every known Indian anarchist in London. Their bravery impressed me, but I felt that their zeal was misguided. I felt that violence was no remedy for India's ills and that a civilization required the use of a different and higher weapon for self-protection. The Satyagraha of South Africa was still an infant, hardly 2 years old, but it had developed sufficiently to permit me to write of it with some degree of confidence.
On his return journey, he writes this little booklet, which is called Hind Swaraj, which is Home Rule for India, which is in the form of questions and answers between an editor and a reader.
Editor:
you want the tiger's nature, but not the tiger. That is to say, you would make India English. And when it becomes English, it will be called not Hindustan, but Englistan. This is not the Swaraj that I want.
Reader:
then from your statement, I deduce that the government of England is not worth copying by us.
Editor:
your deduction is justified. The condition of England at present is pitiable. I pray to God that India may never be in that plight. That which you consider to be the mother of parliaments is like a sterile woman and a prostitute. Both these are harsh terms, but exactly fit the case. The parliament has not yet, of its own accord, done a single good thing.
He wrote it in 10 days flat on the ship, and that's something like 30,000 words he wrote in his left hand and he wrote in his right hand. And so there's furious writing of this. But something like this doesn't just come. It's a growth of his beliefs over a period of time, his lack of faith in technology, his lack of faith in, modern progress.
Reader:
I should like to know your views about the condition of our country.
Editor:
it is a sad condition. In thinking of it, my eyes water and my throat gets parched. I have grave doubts whether I shall be able sufficiently to explain what is in my heart. It is my deliberate opinion that India is being ground down. Not under the English heel, but under that of modern civilization. It is groaning under the monster's terrible weight. There is yet time to escape it, but every day makes it more and more difficult.
Gandhi was shaped by the experience of South Africa. He became a colonist. Now, that meant that the Indian community in South Africa was, in a sense, pushed together by the controls and the inequality that they were subjected to. And so he quite quickly appreciated that in South Africa, it was no longer possible to keep the separation between the castes or to keep the separation between Hindu and Muslim and Sikh. He also came to appreciate that women could play a much greater role in the New World, and it's the New World to the Indians, than they did at home. So Gandhi, in a way, became a modern leader because of his experience in South Africa, a leader for all Indians. Now, he also faced a political system that was oppressive, but not overtly violent, that still, used the rule of law. It was a political situation which was made for his form of resistance. It wouldn't have been necessary in a more liberal society. It would have been counterproductive in a more brutally oppressive society.
Gandhi dealt with the British government, and the apartheid government thrived on divide and rule. It also had the huge police state, the security legislation that was passed, and all this, inspired fear.
And indeed, Smuts has to have a lot of this responsibility. He was the one important leader for the whole of the first half of the 20th century, virtually from the beginning of the 20th century until 1948. He is a central figure. More than anyone else, he might have been able to bring white South Africans along to the idea that eventually they were going to have to come to terms, and that it was, as Merriman had told him long before, if you try and stop this situation developing, that is a mixing of peoples, then ultimately there's going to be a great rebellion.
So, this story about Mohandas Gandhi, Jan Smuts, and the origins of apartheid has come to an end. It would take almost a century for the Mahatma's vision for racial equality in South Africa to become a reality.
Gandhi in South Africa was written and produced by Catherine Gough Brady, and the sound engineer was Gary Havrilay. It featured historians Marilyn Lake, Henry Reynolds, and Uma Mesri, who's the great-granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi. The program was narrated by Candy Bowers. Readings from Jan Smuts' writings were by Kirk Alexander, and Raj Sidhu read from the letters and writings of Mohandas Gandhi. If you'd like more information about this program, including images, references, and some short films about this history, then head to the Hindsight webpage. That's abc.net.au/rn/hindsight.